of this. You can have some version of the theory, but not necessarily the strong version of the theory that is arguably preferred by the more conservative justices.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Vernita Tolson, for joining us and explaining this. I think for most people, it sounds just like sort of a legal gobbledygook, but it absolutely has such a critical effect on voting in the United States, and we'll continue to follow it. Professor Tolson teaches law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. That does it for our show. On Friday, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at the CUNY School of Labor and Urban Studies at 3 p.m. and on Monday at 6:30 p.m. at the CUNY Graduate Center. He'll be talking about the history of Latinos in America. Visit democracynow.org for all details. I look forward to seeing folks there as we all listen to Juan. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, it's back to work in person in Portland for people who work for the city. Local health authorities are warning that too many of us, especially families with kids, are packing into emergency rooms with illnesses like the flu, RSV, and COVID. New efforts to increase training and staff for people in the medical field in the West. And how animals are still feeling the impact of the pandemic. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 8th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler wants workers to come back to the office in person. Josh Salem has more on the story.
Portland's mayor just announced he wants all city employees to work in their offices at least half-time starting next April. Wheeler's office said yesterday that all Portland employees, including people currently working a hybrid schedule, will be expected to meet the new standard. Some exemptions will be approved, however. Wheeler also plans to write a rule requiring employees to work from either Oregon or Washington. The city council would need to adopt that new residency requirement. Wheeler believes the changes will result in better public service and help the city implement the change in government voters approved last month. Portland will no longer have its unique commission form of government in which elected officials serve as both legislators passing policy and administrators overseeing day-to-day operations. Instead, Portland will switch from having 5 citywide council seats to 4 districts, each represented by 3 city council members. The mayor will still be elected, but will no longer be a member of the council. Wheeler said of the in-office working requirement, quote, "This approach provides maximum flexibility for in-person collaboration, while rising to the significant challenges we face in transformation the city is undergoing," end quote. Unions representing city workers are expected to push back against both changes. A survey of municipal workers conducted last June found most had no interest in going back to the office full-time. 3/5 of those working from home part-time said they would quit if the city made them come in more than twice per week. Elected leaders and business groups have been urging both public and private employees to come back for some time. Working in person has been portrayed as critical to the revitalization of downtown. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
More warnings today about the direction of respiratory illnesses in Oregon, putting strain on local hospitals. Dr. Dean Seidlinger with the Oregon Health Authority explains it.
Surging flu, RSV, and COVID-19 cases is pushing hospitals past their current ICU bed capacity, which never happened during the darkest days of our COVID-19 pandemic in Oregon. OHA and Governor Brown are taking action to aid hospitals in this crisis by giving hospitals needed staffing flexibility and providing emergency short-term resources to enable hospitals to bring more nurses and other staff from out of state. Every one of us can protect ourselves and our families from respiratory viruses and prevent them from spreading to other people as another wave of respiratory diseases sweeps the nation and Oregon. Hospitals are overwhelmed and don't have enough beds to treat everyone in the manner that they're accustomed to. Many more children are being hospitalized with breathing problems than in past seasons, especially children under 2. Now, more adults will be at risk of not getting the hospital care they need. We need to protect our kids, our hospitals, and our exhausted healthcare heroes. Wear a mask when you're in crowded indoor places this winter. Let me give you an overview on what we are facing. It is heartbreaking to have to present this information, knowing the tremendous pain that it represents for my fellow Oregonians, their families that are facing illness right now, as well as the healthcare providers taking care of them at this moment. We saw an almost five-fold increase in RSV-associated hospitalizations in Oregon's children between October 23rd and November 13th. And while RSV-associated hospitalizations peaked during the week ending November 19th, rates of hospitalization remain higher than during any previously recorded peak. So while the worst of RSV is behind us, many sick children will continue to require specialized care during the weeks to come. Influenza activity in our communities has doubled week over week for 5 consecutive weeks between October 18th and November 28th. Test percent positivity increased from just 1% to 30%. And flu-related hospitalizations have increased rapidly since late October and are affecting people 65 and older the most. During this short period of time, the hospitalization rate in the elderly has increased tenfold. This year's influenza season has begun earlier than it normally does, and we are seeing high levels of influenza nationwide. We will keep monitoring the influenza situation and its effect on hospitalization, but we do expect flu activity to maintain its upward trajectory into the winter, particularly as the holiday season and gathering with loved ones continues. Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic is not over, and we're seeing warning signs that COVID-19 cases are quickly increasing this respiratory season. Both percent positivity and COVID-19 levels in wastewater have risen, signaling increased spread in our communities. And as expected, there has been a corresponding rise in the number of patients with COVID-19 in hospitals, from 235 to 347 during the past month. An increase of 48% ICU hospitalizations have also risen, from 27 to 35. That increase is 30%. COVID-19 deaths remain flat over the last few months, but as deaths are a lagging indicator, we may unfortunately see that trend change. So what does this all mean for hospitals the rest of this respiratory season? It means our healthcare system will continue to be under severe strain. The latest statewide forecast from OHSU's modeling team, led by Dr. Peter Graven and published December 2nd, projects that surge in respiratory illnesses will keep intense pressure on Oregon hospitals, with a sharp increase in flu cases superseding a steady decline in RSV cases. The number of people in Oregon hospitalized with COVID-19 is expected to peak at about 408 by Monday of next week, although the OHSU forecast suggests the COVID-19 hospitalization peak could be extended if new virus subvariants turn out to be more transmissible, avoid previous immunity, or cause more severe illness. OHA is working closely with Governor Brown to provide staffing relief to Oregon-strained hospitals. Yesterday, Governor Brown has issued a new executive order that continues and expands her November 13th emergency declaration to provide additional flexibility to Oregon hospitals so there are enough healthcare workers to meet current needs. Hospitals can draw on a pool of medical volunteer nurses and physicians and other critical steps that can be taken to care for patients. OHA has helped hospitals bring additional staff and healthcare providers from out of state to help ease Oregon's hospital capacity issues. We expect more than 100 contract nurses and respiratory therapists to be in place in the next week, and OHA is pursuing up to $25 million in additional state funding for supplemental staffing contracts to help address the critical workforce shortages. OHA is also communicating regularly with our healthcare, public health, laboratory, and emergency preparedness communities through the Health Alert Network, or HAN, to provide updates on the surge response, medical treatment, vaccination and testing supplies, investigative guidelines, clinical recommendations, and prevention and health promotion messages. But we also want everyone to know there are simple steps you can take to slow the transmission of these respiratory viruses. We're all tired of dealing with these respiratory diseases, but we know what works to keep our families and our neighbors safe. Wear a mask when you're in crowded indoor places this winter and stay up to date on your vaccinations. Masks work, period. During the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Oregonians wore masks at higher rates than people did in most other states. Oregon had one of the lowest COVID-19 death rates in the nation. Our hospitals were never overwhelmed, and we saved more than 5,000 lives. For the next several weeks, wear a mask to the grocery store and any other crowded indoor locations. A mask will protect you and your family from getting sick and missing out on the joys of the holiday season. More people wearing masks will slow the spread of these diseases, protect children, and help keep hospital beds available for people who need them. Consider changing or postponing gatherings if your family includes young children, older adults, or individuals with underlying conditions. Stay home and limit contact with others if you're sick. Cover your coughs and sneezes with the inside of your elbow, or do that into a tissue that you throw away. And wash your hands regularly with soap and water, or use hand sanitizer. It's not too late to get your flu shot or your COVID booster. Vaccines help protect you from getting sick and developing a severe case of respiratory disease and spreading that to others. I know these messages are not what anyone wants to hear in the middle of the holiday season for the third time in as many years. But as Oregonians, we've proven we can protect ourselves, our kids, and our hospitals by taking these simple steps.
That's Dr. Dean Seidlinger with the Oregon Health Authority. And speaking with Dr. Seidlinger about how the outbreaks of illnesses are affecting kids, here's Dr. Wendy Hassan with Randall Children's Hospital.
What's going on in the pediatric world is truly historic nationwide and also here in Oregon. We're seeing historically high levels of respiratory viruses, RSV, at record high levels. And I'm happy to say that that's finally going down, but it's going down very slowly and is still at extremely high levels. We're seeing just rapidly escalating numbers of influenza admissions, as well as other admissions for COVID-19, rhinovirus, and enterovirus. And as a result of this, we are seeing record number of emergency room visits, urgent care visits, hospital admissions, and pediatric ICU admissions. I want to be clear that this really is a first for Oregon, that we have seen this. We have dealt with respiratory surges every single season, every single year. But this operating above capacity really is historic and new. I do want to be reassuring to parents that pediatric providers are extremely comfortable and familiar with managing these respiratory illnesses. RSV, influenza, these are all very familiar diseases that we treat frequently. And children, particularly ones who are previously healthy, can do extremely well if they receive the supportive care that they need in a timely manner, meaning that they receive oxygen therapy, antibiotics, and sometimes even ventilator support. We expect that their outcomes will be good. And so I want to be clear that the crisis that we're dealing with in pediatrics is a crisis of a lack of healthcare personnel, a lack of respiratory therapists, nurses, and support staff. And so that's why it was so important that we declared crisis standards of care in November in order to allow all of the pediatric facilities to provide care as creatively as possible, because we are committed to delivering care to all of the children that need it within Oregon and Southwest Washington in as timely a manner as we're able to. And crisis standards of care allows us to do that. We know that our community partners have really been stretching themselves. I have been impressed time and time again by how amazing the emergency departments have been in these community hospitals. But it's really important that children, particularly very small children or very sick children, receive care at children's hospitals where the staff have received specialized training to care for them. And so we are doing absolutely everything we can to make sure that every child that needs our care gets to us. And sometimes that means that we're being creative. So maybe a child comes to the emergency room instead of directly to a hospital bed, or maybe we're doubling up patients. And so what I want the public to know is that care may look a little bit different, but we are still doing everything we can to provide that care. And so we do ask for grace from the public, as we may not be able to offer the amenities that they're used to, such as private rooms. So your child may have to share a room. Your child may have to be seen in the hallway. But the most important thing is that your child receives the medical care that they need when they need it. I do want to focus on what families can do to help protect their own children, as well as the resources of the pediatric community. And so I want to stress that we are seeing rapid numbers of flu cases being admitted to the hospital. And I will say, I have admitted many patients over the last 2 weeks with the flu, and I have not admitted a single patient who has received a flu vaccine. Flu vaccines work. They keep kids out of the hospital, and I cannot stress this enough. If you have been on the fence about getting your flu vaccine, now is the time to get one immediately to keep your child out of the hospital. I also want to encourage parents to be really thoughtful about what they're saying yes to right now. Now is not the time to go to crowded indoor places like indoor birthday parties, play places, restaurants, grocery stores. Anything you can do to keep your child out of a crowded indoor area will help protect your child and the resources of the community. I want to encourage parents, particularly of very young babies, to feel empowered to say no to visitors. That can be really hard, but now is the time to say no, thank you. I do not want visitors seeing my young baby. And masking works. So anytime you have to go to an indoor crowded area during this surge, if you and your child can wear a mask, that will also help protect the resources for all children in Oregon.
That's Dr. Wendy Hassan with Randall Children's Hospital. The pool of healthcare workers in Idaho is also scarce, but an apprenticeship program aims to increase the number of medical and dental assistants. As Eric Tegedoff reports, they're providing hands-on education and workforce training.
It's tough to find workers for Idaho's health clinics right now, but an apprenticeship program is hoping to address these woes. Nearly 3 years of the pandemic have led to turnover and burnout in the medical field, and workers are hard to find with unemployment numbers so low. To deal with the crunch, the Idaho Community Health Centers Association is collaborating with North Idaho College and the Idaho Department of Labor on a statewide apprenticeship program where students can earn while they learn. Robin Donovan is with the association.
We know that there's a huge shortage for medical assistants and dental assistants, and those are a little bit more entry-level positions coming into a clinic. It doesn't require a degree, and so we looked at ways to bring these apprenticeship programs across the state.
Donovan says the goal was to create a program that wouldn't be a burden for their organization or clinics to manage. Since January, one student has graduated from the dental assistance program, and six more are expected to graduate this month. The dental assistant apprenticeship is 4.5 months, and the medical assistant apprenticeship is 8.5 months. Students not on North Idaho College's campus in Coeur d'Alene work with clinical preceptors or experienced clinicians in their community. Marty Matney with the North Idaho College Workforce Training Center says the pandemic has shown the school how it can be successful at a distance.
We're very successful in our medical assistant apprenticeship because we've benefited from COVID, if you can believe that, in that we have learned how to take a program that is largely hands-on and put it online.
Donovan notes that the apprenticeship program also can create career ladders for people and says that program helps local communities.
They're 80% more likely to stay in that clinic, in that community, and continue working. So it's a great retention tool for the employer to offer those types of training.
Matney says higher education is adapting post-COVID.
Higher ed is playing a role right now by being flexible and responding to the needs of the community.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
California's pandemic protections held the line on children's health insurance, according to new data. More on that from Suzanne Potter.
During 2021, the first year after the pandemic, California managed to keep more than 96% of children insured, according to a new report from Georgetown University. The authors credit a federal law that gives states extra money so no one would be dropped from Medicaid during COVID. Joan Alker with the Georgetown Center for Children and Families says those protections are slated to lapse when the national health emergency ends next spring and predicts the national child uninsured rate could double.
3 out of every 4 children that may lose Medicaid coverage will still be eligible. Sometimes children lose coverage at Medicaid renewal just because the letter gets lost in the mail. Families with limited English proficiency may have more trouble getting through the renewal process successfully.
Next spring, Medi-Cal will likely resume its annual re-evaluations of recipients' eligibility. Alker says all states need to launch a massive outreach campaign to make sure no eligible child is dropped, and parents need to make sure Medi-Cal has their correct address. Myra Alvarez with the Children's Partnership notes that California's most recent budget included money to keep all children on Medi-Cal continuously covered until age 5. But there's a catch.
The state is not slated to implement that provision until 2025. So we're urging the state to move as quickly as possible with those protections, so that our children don't drop off of the rolls.
Nationally, the child uninsured rate in the U.S. was 5.4% in 2021, down slightly from 2019. That reverses a trend from the Trump years when the rate of uninsured children went up. I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Rosetti Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves on the people of the Red Mountain. Tonight's weather, considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers, the low reaching 36. Tomorrow's weather, rain very likely, a high of 42. Today in history, we look at a critical moment for our country and get some insight from Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols, a history professor at Ohio State University. December 8th, 1863, Abraham Lincoln issued his Amnesty Proclamation and plan for reconstruction of the South. Obviously a pivotal moment in American history.
So that was a big one. The proclamation of amnesty was very controversial because there were some in the Union who definitely wanted a much more vituperative and tough peace, right? A really kind of scorched earth policy. And of course, remember, 63, the war is far from over. At this point, you know, it's clear Lincoln had to be making some plans for what the post-war would look like, but at the same time, the Union armies had secured lots of territory. It wasn't a foregone conclusion that they'd win, and in 1864 is the next election, and there was a real question about whether or not Lincoln would win. So this was a moment for him to put out a kind of important statement that in some ways, in the way that he articulated it, would be easy for Southerners to get behind, at least theoretically, as opposed to, say, you know, a much more sweeping kind of reconstruction of society. So it did a couple things. It allowed for pardons and restoration of property, and it did something else. The new formation of new governments coming out of the Confederacy with a rule of something like 10% of eligible voters had to take an oath of allegiance to the U.S. So, and these are the same things that get operationalized after in the Reconstruction moment. Southern states then, if they were admitted, if they got 10%-ish of eligible voters to take the oath, then they could come back for full statehood. But the next step of that, which you find out later in this history, is that they had to accept the so-called Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that, among other things, and most importantly, fully emancipated slaves and gave African-Americans, African-American men, theoretically, full citizenship rights, including the vote.
Thanks so much to historian and author Dr. Chris Nichols for shedding more light on this date in history. Raphael Warnock wins re-election and secures and adds to a Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate. The Supreme Court hears a crucial election law case, and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff condemns a growing tide of anti-Semitic speech. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2022 Talks.
It is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. The people have spoken.
Senator Raphael Warnock has been reelected in a runoff, defeating his Republican opponent Herschel Walker and giving Democrats a 51-seat majority in the Senate. Democrats will no longer have to negotiate a power agreement with Republicans over the next 2 years. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday in Moore v. Harper over a redrawn congressional district map by the North Carolina legislature. At its core, the case is focused on a widely discredited legal doctrine known as the independent state legislature theory, which would allow legislatures to set district boundaries without the possibility of review by state courts. Justice Alina Kagan says it would allow legislatures to engage in extreme gerrymandering.
I think what might strike a person is that this is a proposal that gets rid of the normal checks and balances on the way big governmental decisions are made in this country. And you might think that it gets rid of all those checks and balances at exactly the time when they are needed most.
Dr. Roy Guerrero, a Texas pediatrician who treated victims of the Uvalde school shooting earlier this year, was joined Wednesday at the Capitol by Senators Dick Durbin and Richard Blumenthal and members of the March 4th coalition to call for the Senate to vote on banning assault-style weapons during the lame duck session.
We are bleeding out and you are not there. You're sitting in your office filling out paperwork so you can get paid. And my oath as a doctor means I signed up to save lives. I do my job and I guess out. I am here to plead, to beg, to please do yours.
Senator Durbin said in his eyes, amid a rush to pass dozens of bills as the session ends, there is no more important issue. The House has already passed the measure. Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff and Jewish leaders participated in a discussion at the White House, which condemned a growing tide of anti-Semitic rhetoric by influential figures, some of whom have been associated with former President Donald Trump.
I will not remain silent. And I'm proud to be Jewish. I'm proud to live openly as a Jew, and I'm not afraid. We cannot live in fear.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A tribal schoolyard pilot program's launched in 6 states, and dozens of bison are transferred to tribal herds. For these stories and more, here's National Native News.
The Trust for Public Land, or TPL, has announced a pilot program to bring green community schoolyards to tribal communities nationwide. Schools in Idaho, Arizona, Wisconsin, Montana, and New Mexico are taking part, as well as 3 South Dakota communities. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keene has more.
The program is a joint effort between the TPL and Bureau of Indian Education. It was announced at the recent White House Tribal Nations Summit. Danielle Dank is the TPL's Community School Yards Initiative Director. She says these spaces are valuable for many reasons.
It just really makes a 3-dimensional learning environment for students. A wonderful place for, you know, teachers and school staff to go outside and, you know, decompress a bit. And then for the community, these are open, more than not, they're open to the community after hours, which means that they provide all the benefits that a park would provide.
Dank says TPL will take a back seat in the design process.
Our role is to bring our process, but not to be the lead locally. We really are looking to work with tribal and indigenous designers, organizers, folks who would be aligned with this kind of process to be the local lead.
One South Dakota school involved in the program is the Crazy Horse School in Wanblee. Superintendent Margot Heinert says experiential education is important.
Educationally, I really support anytime we can do some hands-on learning activities. I think our kids learn a lot better that way. We are working on an elementary playground, but we wanted something more educational oriented for older kids. And so when that phone call was made and I got in on a conference call with them, it just fit our schedule perfectly.
Other South Dakota schools involved in the program are the Pine Ridge School and the Rock Creek Grant School in Bullhead. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
A Bozeman-based nonprofit announced Wednesday that it has transferred dozens of bison to tribal herds in Montana and Washington State. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
In recent weeks, American Prairie transferred 45 bison to the Rocky Boy Reservation and to the Kalispell Tribe in Cusick, Washington. The Rocky Boy herd was first established last year with help from both the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes and American Prairie. The Rocky Boy herd received 10 bison this year to strengthen the herd. The tribe plans to use the bison for, quote, food, shelter, clothing, and cultural education. American Prairie provides bison to tribal herds every year and has sent 350 animals to tribes since 2005. The organization says all animals were tested for disease and received a clean bill of health. American Prairie has been working to build a 3.2 million acre reserve for bison and other wildlife in north central Montana. Some ranchers and state Republican politicians have pushed back against the nonprofit's efforts, in part due to their concerns about bison spreading disease to cattle. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The COVID-related crisis continues for animals and animal shelters, with many shelters overflowing across the United States. Roz Brown has more on the story.
Adopting a pet was a lifesaver for many folks isolated during the pandemic.
2 years later, many animal shelters face crisis-level intakes with decreased adoptions. Carolyn Ortega with Animal Welfare Department says despite a Black Friday event that saw 157 of 900 animals adopted, about 55 are surrendered each day, making it difficult to keep up. The problem started with the pandemic, according to Ortega, when almost 3 million neuter spay surgeries were not performed,
which basically caused a domino effect, resulting in multiple litters being born in 2020 and 2021. So we're seeing the results of that.
She says some animals have been at the Albuquerque shelter for 6 months to a year, which can cause them to develop emotional or behavioral problems. Research shows that 75% of people surrendering animals are not doing so because of behavioral issues or because they don't want the pet. Ortega says right now, a downturn in the economy is a contributing factor because many are downsizing from homes to apartments.
Some of the larger dogs are being brought in because they don't have the yard space anymore that they had with the home, or the apartment that they're moving into. It has such a high deposit for anyone who's bringing in an animal.
The Albuquerque Animal Shelters will participate in a Holiday Happiness adoption event this weekend. Ortega says adoption fees, vaccinations, microchipping, and spay-neuter services will all be free.
They get a free first dog training, and then their first vet visit is paid for as well. It's covered through the adoption. So it's almost like we're paying you to take a pet, and all we're asking is that you give them a loving home.
This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to an end of year membership drive edition of the KABU Evening News for Thursday, December 8th, 2022. This is a volunteer produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegadoff, Roz Brown, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service, Native Voice One, and Dr. Chris Nichols. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KABU programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KABU is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321.